Pre-commit started as a framework for running linters and code formatters during Git actions via Git hooks. It's grown and expanded and now supports an extensive list of languages and actions and manual running of actions. Anthony Sotilli discusses pre-commit for using locally by developers and pre-commit CI, which can run actions during merge requests.
Welcome to Test and Code. If you've found value in this podcast, could you do me a favor? Could you go over to pythontest.com and look either in the top menu bar or in the bottom footer? And there's a few links we're going to talk about. Contact is how you can get a hold of me. Newsletter is how I can get a hold of you. And support is how you can find links to things like my book, the PyTest book, PyTest courses, the community where you can ask questions, and that's about it, really. I'd really appreciate if, especially if you could sign up for the newsletter. I'm trying to collect emails of people that might be interested in similar topics.
Let's talk about pre-commit.
Sure. So the idea behind pre-commit is, well, the original idea behind pre-commit was that it was a Git hooks runner, but you only had to manage a small set of configuration, and it would install and run all those tools for you in a bunch of different programming languages. So despite pre-commit being written in Python, it supports, I think, like 8 or 9 native programming languages at the moment. So, you know, Python, JavaScript, Ruby, Rust, Go. You can run Docker files. It has a portable grep alternative. There's a whole bunch of languages, and it's really easy to plug in new ones. Oh, it supports the .NET framework, Corsair, which is like a Java package manager, JVM package manager. It has a whole bunch of language support. And, like, you know, the big difference between other tools is Flake 8 will manage and install all these tools for you, so your developers don't have to worry about, oh, do I have the wrong version of Ruby, and I have the wrong version of this particular linter code formatter tool installed. Like, no, you don't worry about that. Pre-commit just manages it for you, and you don't have to think about it.
Okay.
It has, you know, spread a little bit beyond the initial Git hooks idea. You can use it without involving Git hooks at all, just as a linter and code formatter runner. You can also use it as a CI tool, which, you know, runs your code formatters and linters and makes sure that your code stays up to date with your particular style. Because the configuration file is versioned, you can make lockstep changes to your linters and code formatters. You don't have the situation where, like, oh, we're changing, you know, Flake 8 to 3.9 everywhere, and, you know, everyone at your every repository of your company is suddenly broken because it doesn't, you know, fit the latest set of lint rules or whatever. But no, you can change that version with the code bumps that you're making. So it allows you to keep things, you know, in line.
And so there's this idea of it doesn't have to be just one configuration, right? You can have like these pre-commit snippets or something.
So kind of works like that. So the way that you install tools is, it uses Git repositories as its lowest common denominator, because you can't really have higher level representation than that that works for every different programming language. And inside each remote repository, there's a small bit of configuration which sets up sensible defaults for that tool. So for instance, the Flake 8 tool runs Flake 8 against Python files. That is encoded in a little YAML file that sits inside Flake 8's repository. And if you want to use Flake 8, you just reference Flake 8 and a version number and the hook ID that you want to use from that. And okay, it will include that base configuration, and then you could override it if you need it. So you can override it with inclusion or exclusion, or, you know, make it run on different file types, or have particular command line arguments, or whatever you need to do to extend that tool. And so what your pre-commit config tends to look like is, it's a list of repositories that reference remote tools to, you know, run all the things that you would want. There's also an escape hatch. If you don't want to reference remote repositories, you can use what's called the local repository. It's kind of a special sigil that lets you, you know, escape from the repository-based installation. And there you can leverage the package managers for each project, or for each language. So if you wanted to use pip directly, you could set up a local hook. of course, you don't get all the niceties of the default base configuration. You have to specify every bit of the configuration yourself. You can also set up just like system hooks or script hooks, which either live in the repository itself or are externally managed tools. So you can still have the old school, like, you know, systems team that manages your tools on your machine and upgrades those out of band with your configuration. You just reference them globally using pre-commit.
And in
that case, it's mostly good for standardizing all of the weird edges around Git that are encoded in pre-commit's code base for, like, you know, managing merge conflicts, resolution, linter running. Like that one's a common problem when working with other Git frameworks. Like the naive approach is just run against everything in the merge conflict, which most of the times isn't the code that you touch. You don't care about that other file that someone else introduced to linter, and you're really concerned with, you know, the files that conflicted, the files that I touched. Another thing that it deals with that's kind of tricky is applying patches to partially staged commits. Like you want to make sure that you're only linting the stuff that's about to be checked in and not the stuff that's not going to be checked in. So you can have both false positives and false negatives based on those unstaged contents. And pre-commit is careful to, you know, stash those changes out and only check the ones that are about to be checked in. Of course, you end up in a whole different set of complicated problems because, well, what if the stash then conflicts with the changes that were made? And like, there's you know, clever roll forward and roll back cases for those.
Wow. That sounds complicated. I'm glad you came up with it instead of me.
I've learned so much about, you know, Git and different programming languages, package managers, and how to bootstrap all these things from nothing. And like, I found, you know, close to 10 or 20 bugs in Git so far just from the crazy edge cases that have come up as part of this project. Like, I've learned a ton building this, and there's a lot of knowledge that's encoded in the tool.
So a lot of people will probably run this tied to some Git events, though, right? Mm-hmm. And from its name, the first one you thought of was pre-commit. But there's other places you can tie in code. Where can I run code in different parts of my workflow?
Yeah, so I think there's something like 8 or 10 Git hooks that are configured right now. And there are some that have not been implemented yet. It's really been, you know, if somebody has a use case for this, they'll come along and implement that additional Git hook. And for the most popular ones are pre-commit, of course. There's also pre-push, which runs as you're pushing a branch. There is commit message and prepare commit message, which are fired when you're making the message for a commit. So it allows you to, you know, make sure your ticket number's in there, or auto-format the ticket it in, or things like that, or, you know, enforce your messaging style, you know, declarative sentences, blah blah blah.
You can run linters and stuff on your messages.
Yep. Yeah. It's actually cool. Pretty popular. I find it really annoying, but it's pretty popular. People do it. What else is there? There's some for like repository states. So like there's post checkout, which runs after you switch branches or after you know, merge a particular change or do something like that, which people often use to, you know, generate or synchronize a generated file in the workspace, or like make sure that, you know, IDE metadata is up to date or stuff like that. What are the other ones? Let me just look at the docs really quickly. I mostly just use the pre-commit stage and don't really worry about the rest of them, but other people use the rest of them. Okay, so there's commit, there's merge commit, which happens during merge. We talked about push, talked about prepare commit message, we talked about post checkout. Oh, post commit. So there is despite the tool being called pre-commit, there is a post commit hook that is also supported. Post-commit, you can't really do any validation, but again, you could generate metadata or do whatever you need to do afterwards. There's also post-merge, and then there's a special stage called manual, which allows you to invoke pre-commit. You know, invoke a tool that doesn't run at any Git stage, but you might use it as a one-off execution. And that's where pre-commit becomes more of an execution engine and less of like a Git hooks tool.
Well, that's actually going to be my next question. Can I, if I just have like, this is, it sounds interesting to me. So
There's times mm-hmm. where, like in a post commit or maybe a post merge or something like that, or mm-hmm. Where it might make sense to me to kick off like a notification message or something to people.
Mm-hmm.
Can I write my own tool and hook it into pre-commit then?
Yep, absolutely. So there's the classical repository based tooling where you would set up a Git repository, write an executable, write a little pre-commit hooks.yaml file that says I provide this hook, and then you can plug that in into your consuming repository. So this allows you to have like a reusable tool. If it's a one-off tool, it probably makes more sense to write that code directly in the repository that you're worried about and use a local hook to reference that. But yeah, anyone can write their own set of hooks, basically just providing the necessary metadata to make that happen.
And I can mix and match in the configuration. I can have some tools that are Git based hooks and or tools, and then others that are just my own and stuff.
Yep. Yeah. You can mix and match what hooks you're targeting as well. So you can have your pre-commit and pre-push hooks live side by side. You could have commit message hooks configured directly as well. And pre-commit's smart about finding just the ones that satisfy that particular stage and running them.
Now for Python projects, let's say I want to try this out on a mm-hmm. project, and I just, I've listened to this episode and it's I kind of understand what's going on, but I don't know the formatting or anything. Is there a good bootstrap way to just like hook up a couple of these tools to my project and try it out?
Yeah, there's a quick start guide on precommit.com. That's pre-commit.com. The other website is owned by some weird construction site that I've been trying to ping the owner about for a while and pay them good money to take it, but we'll see what happens with that. But yeah, there's a quick start guide on precommit.com, which walks you through setting up a basic precommit configuration that this particular configuration is very simple. It includes black and some white space fixers, and it guides you through, setting up the basis to get started. What I would actually recommend is finding another repository which already configures precommit, figure out what tools they're using, and copy paste their config. There's also a list of supported hooks on the precommit website as well, which is basically just a large catalog of things that you might want to use. For Python projects, what I recommend is kind of three or four tools. One, an import sorter, so either isource or reorder Python imports. A code formatter, things like Black, AutoPEP8, or YIPF, and a checker, Flake8 usually. And you can also, layer in your whitespace checkers, your YAML checkers, JSON checkers, whatever you want to do. But that's usually what I recommend for getting started. And if you want to look at any one of my repositories, they are all configured with pre-commit and have a whole bunch of other related tools as well. So like one example is PyUpgrade, which is a tool which takes, old syntax and upgrades it to newer, nicer syntax. So for instance, it'll take .format calls and upgrade them to fstrings if you've told PyUpgrade that I want Python 3.6 plus, for instance. Or it'll take for loops that can be converted into yield froms, things like that.
Okay, well, let's drop. I picked a bad example, I think, because I thought, well, I know that PyTest uses pre-commit. Let's see what theirs is. And it's a little overwhelming.
Kind of complicated.
Yeah. but it is kind of neat. It has some of the common ones, but then it also has some local tooling. They have some local hooks. So
we've set up an RST linter because I'm terrible at writing RST. I don't know about you, but I find it really, really hard to write correctly. We also have some stuff that makes sure that the change logs are in a good format. This is a me problem. I would typo the file names pretty often, and like that would cause them to not end up in the release. And so we made a little filter to make sure that you match the exact file name format and we end up in the right place. We're also deprecating some internal stuff. So like pylib, we're trying to excise from the code base. And so we're working through making sure that that doesn't exist anywhere. And those are kind of our special one-off,
okay. So where's a different example that might be easier?
Precommit has a very straightforward.
So if I just look at GitHub precommit.
Yep, precommit. I guess it has a few things that you wouldn't necessarily use in another project. Like the first pre-commit hook was actually pre-commit itself. So a little self-referential, but it does the self-reference there. So maybe pre-commit/pre-commit hooks is a good starting point, because that's a very, you know, straightforward one. It of course hooks. Encodes my particular preferences for style, which may not be in line with yours, and so, like, you know, feel free to swap out whatever tools you want. Like, I prefer auto pet bait over black personally. I also use, well, I guess my black equivalent is called add trailing comma, which existed several years before black, and, you know, encodes a very particular calling construct, but it doesn't do all the other stuff that black does.
Yeah. Okay. So I had a relationship with black. No, my first reaction is, I think I like almost everything it's doing, but it's the almost part that caught me. And I particularly kind of like single quoted strings instead of the double Same. Quotes, but it really wasn't a mountain that I really wanted to battle for. So,
yeah.
You know,
I usually find that, like, I think black is an overwhelmingly good thing for the community. I don't use it myself because I don't like some of the minor things, but I think the goal of eliminating conversations around style preference yeah. is great. It saves, well, it's the jury's still out on whether it saves time, because it should save time by avoiding these conversations. Of course, it seems to trigger more conversations about, like, well, I don't like black, so we should use something else. And then, like, that whole rabbit hole.
Okay, but so I think, like, let's talk about your tools, though. So auto pep 8 you use instead of mm-hmm. black. My concern would be, is auto pep 8 maintained as well as black is? So is there decent maintenance on auto pep 8?
Yep. Yeah, I know the maintainer of auto pep 8. Okay. They're very good about keeping things up to date. That said, auto pep 8 does a lot less than black. It is mostly responses to error codes that PyCode style emits.
Okay.
And so, like, unless it's an error in the PyCode style tool, AutoPep8 tends to avoid, you know, changing your code.
But that might be a good starting point. So to start with AutoPep8 on a project that's already existing, that would be fairly non-political to add that mm-hmm. to something. And then
usually when I talk about adoption of Flake 8, my recommendation is, like, run AutoPep 8 on your code base just to start with, because it's going to save you a lot of time worrying about individual, you know, lint rules. It'll solve like 80% of them for you.
Okay. And then what's the import sorter you use?
I wrote my own import sorter called Reorder Python Imports.
That's a this long was, name, man.
Yeah. I mean, I like you know, non-silly names. I tend to prefer, like, this is what it does. Of course, pre-commit is a terrible name, so I'm not exactly perfect about it. Okay. But Reorder Python Imports was written mostly with pre-commit in mind. The original idea was that it would notice the structure of your repository and know which things are, you know, system, third-party, and first-party imports. And at the time, I want to say iSort was GPL'd, so I didn't want to... I didn't want to contribute to it because I wouldn't have been able to use it at work. So I wrote my own clean room, unrelated implementation of that.
Okay. But iSort's another common one, though, right?
Yep. iSort is another import sorter. It has a lot of configuration options. So it's a very configurable import sorter. You can pick a number of different styles, another number of different options for it. At the time, it didn't support discovering the structure of your repository, so it didn't really know what was first party versus not, so you had to manually configure all that. But the latest version of iSort now does essentially the same work that Reorder Python Imports does, so it figures out your repository structure and can order things, you know, properly. I actually, funny coincidence, I actually work with the maintainer of iSort at Stripe.
So do you, like, ever, you know, have battles on this?
I mean, no. Okay. And, like, I use my own thing. He uses his own thing. We did talk a little bit about, like, some of the strategies there. And, like my initial reason for writing Reorder Python Imports was due to licensing. And iSort is actually re-licensed since that happened. So a lot of my original reasons for forking off my own project are, I guess, no longer super relevant.
Okay, one of the things is the configuration. I can use iSort without any configuration also, right?
You can, however, it won't necessarily play nicely with the rest of your tools. So, like, iSort out of the box doesn't play nicely with Black. Reorder okay. Python imports does. I don't know of any incompatible tools with it at the moment, other than iSort.
Okay, well, that's a benefit. And then checkers... You're using Flake 8, is that right?
Yep, I'm using Flake 8. I'm also using MyPy, which is a type checker. And I'm using a bunch of one-off checkers. So, like, I have a JSON checker. I have a checker for large files. I have a checker for YAML. I have a checker for checking in debug statements. So how many times have you shipped an import PDB or a breakpoint to prod? This will check, prevent that from happening. I also have a thing that enforces a naming convention on my tests. I have a few
Ooh,
fixers.
Neat. What's that called?
This one is called name tests test. Again, like my very convenient naming of tools. And that one comes from pre-commit hooks directly. So if you use pre-commit okay. hooks, you'll have that one. But it enforces, like, you can either force having test at the beginning or having test at the end of your file names. I prefer test at the end because then tab completion works, but to each their own.
You write the name test at the end of the thing?
Yeah. Well, otherwise, like, I'm in a directory and I go to type, like, the module name and it's, oh, wait, it starts with test. I have to backspace, type test, press tab twice, then type the module name. I find that really annoying.
Okay.
yeah, personal preferences, right?
No, it's all good. It's interesting. And I think it's neat that I definitely want to grab some of those because we have a few JSON files that we use for various reasons during testing, and we check them into the to Git. And
yeah, the number of times we broke in prod from, like, shipping a bad YAML file at Yelp was way too high, so we added a bunch of these hooks to, like, validate YAML syntax before deploying.
Now, one of the concerns might be, let's say I'm running this stuff a lot. Like, people are hitting this, a team is hitting this a lot. Mm-hmm. Is there any caching going on?
Yep. Primo cache it's actually a complicated caching scheme because it's really hard to get correct, but it uses, I think, a 5-tuple of things. So the repository itself, the version it's at, the language it's using, the language version it's using, and any additional dependencies that you're pulling along into that. And it'll cache that across a machine. So if you're on a single machine, I guess it'll cache it per user on that machine. So if you're using check YAML from pre-commit hooks, you'll have, one version of that on your host per version. And it's pretty good about deduplicating. And my recommendation is to just continually auto-update to the latest version, which will minimize your cache size because everything will be on the latest.
How do I auto? What do you mean by that?
Pre-commit has a convenient command for upgrading the versions of everything. So you can run pre-commit auto update, and it'll just take the versions that you've encoded into your config file and bump those to the latest tag.
Okay. But, right. And then one of the other things is, so I install pre-commit, I configure it with something, I copy somebody's other YAML file, which I don't think anybody actually writes YAML. I think everybody copies YAML from somewhere else.
Human writable, aka human copy pastable.
Okay, then, but I don't. But normally, like, let's say I hook it up to commit a commit hook, for instance, or push hook. It's only going to run on stuff that changed, right?
Yep.
So I really want to run it once at least against everything.
Yep. So there's a pre-commit run dash dash all files, which I recommend whenever adding or removing a tool.
Okay. And that's it. That's listed in the quick start.
Yep. Well. That's the optional last step of a quick start, just to run it against your existing code and make sure that you're already adhering to it.
And I actually like to run. I like to hook up a handful of tools that I don't really need. And some that I do, some that I don't. And then so that I can run this whenever I want to, when things are not going well during my work day, and I can run this and I go, well, this works still.
Mm-hmm. You can also run pre-commit through talks, which works well as well. So there's, another.
You can get talks to run pre-commit.
Yep.
Okay. Well, I guess you could, right? It just calls it, right?
Yep. So I often, before pre-commit CI, which we haven't gotten to yet, before pre-commit CI, I would run, a talks job that ran pre-commit run --- all files, and --- show diff on failure as well, because that would be easier to debug in CI. But yeah, that's how I used to do it.
Let's do pre-commit CI. What's this?
So the idea behind pre-commit CI is it takes all of the good parts of pre-commit, so installing and running tools, and all that part, and builds a CI system around it. So previously, I would run pre-commit in talks in CI, and it would tell me a pass fail about whether things adhered to code style correctly.
I got to back up a little bit. Why do I need that? If I'm running it before I commit it, how could it break in the CI server?
So Git hooks are all optional opt-in client-side hooks. So there's nothing that actually enforces that all of your users are using this. And especially when you're working with open source projects, you don't really expect a drive-by contributor to set up all of your developer tooling. They might not even run the tests. They might not even write any tests. They might not run the linters or code formatters. They might just, commit their change from the GitHub UI and move on with their life. And so pre-commit CI is kind of aimed at two types of users. One is ensuring that in every case, the code base still adheres to all the style, and to the set of individuals that don't run the developer tooling that would do this stuff for you. And it's kind of just like an actual gating mechanism to make sure your code stays up to style. There are also situations where resolving merge conflicts, you'd run no verify sometimes, there's some cases where you would intentionally avoid as part of your workflow the developer tooling. I mean, another one is you're on a work in progress branch and you're just trying to commit something. You don't really care about whether it adheres to style. But when you finally go to integrate that branch, you want to make sure that it does adhere to style. So there's cases where you wouldn't run the tools. But pre-commit CI is, it basically takes what I used to run in talks in GitHub Actions or Azure Pipelines or whatever, and builds an app around that. And it also provides some much nicer things than that. So if your code was not formatted properly, which happens a surprising amount in open source, pre-commit CI will take that and just commit it directly to your pull request. So it'll auto-fix a pull request that's not formatted properly. It also is, really good. I talked about that cache before. It's really good about sharing that cache across all of the users so that you can get really, really fast runs just because someone else uses that tool. Whereas if you're using If you're using a kind of classical CI tool, you would manage caches per repository, and you wouldn't get to share stuff, and it would be way slower and way more work and way more data storage to maintain that. So what pre-commit CI does is it shares those environments across all users. So it's much, much faster. Also it's optimized for this specific workflow. So it can do a lot of stuff that makes running much speedier. So the average time to start is under 2 seconds for pre-commit CI, whereas with GitHub Actions, it's 5 or 6 seconds, and GitLab CI, it's 3 minutes or something ridiculous. Travis CI, it's a minute or so. But pre-commit CI can be very, very quick about this. Sometimes I've seen runs where I push a pull request and pre-commit CI completes before GitHub Actions even starts.
So if I've got a project that has a pre-commit YAML or something, mm-hmm. do I need to set up a different one?
Nope, it works completely off of your existing pre-commit config. So you need zero configuration to get started. You really just set up the GitHub app, point at your repository, and it does the rest. There are some CI-specific configurations that you can set up if you need to make changes, although the default should be reasonable for most use cases.
Okay, but I'm still being dense. But let's say I've just set up hooks to go to my pre-commit mm-hmm. as a pre-commit hit or pre-push hook.
Yep.
Those two events aren't happening on CI. I'm doing merges right. and stuff.
So currently pre-commit assumes... so pre-commit by default, when you run pre-commit run, it assumes the pre-commit stage. And CI basically takes that same approach as well. So anything that you've hooked up for the pre-commit stage will run in CI.
Okay, good. That's essentially what I would want. So.
Yeah. It essentially runs pre-commit run --- all files. It's a little bit different behind the scenes, but that's essentially what it does.
Okay. So it's going to catch everything, and it's good. And then does it report to the person that tried to commit?
So what it does is it, it'll report a GitHub status, so your pull requests will be green or red based on that, but it'll also push to the branch if it needs to autofix it. So if there's a change that needs to be made from a code format or whatever, it'll just autofix the pull request for you.
Okay. So I'm being a little confused. Somebody does a pull request.
Mm-hmm.
Does it run on the pull request branch then, or?
So it merges the pull request branch with the main repository and checks that.
Okay.
Yeah, because your branch might be out of date.
Okay.
And GitHub does that merge automatically for you. So I just wait for that merge to be successful, and then pre-commit CI will run across that.
Okay, and so let's say somebody does something that breaks that, and the person trying to do the merge request, they can check it to see if it finished or something. Okay. Yep.
Yeah. The other thing that pre-commit CI does, we mentioned earlier that you encode the versions of tools in a file, and there's a developer tool to run pre-commit auto update and upgrade those versions to the latest. Pre-commit CI will run a periodic task that does that auto updating for you, similar to like a Dependabot or something. And it'll send you a currently weekly pull request to make sure those are up to date. Actually ran, I think, 30 minutes ago. So in a bit, I'll make sure that my phone going off isn't a page for it erroring, but I'm pretty sure it was a text message. So I should be fine. Yeah. I think we're good.
Do you need to go?
No, I think I'm fine.
Okay.
Worst case, there isn't an SLA. So within like 15 minutes, I'll check on it anyway. And I can always rerun any failed runs, so that's easy.
How do people find pre-commit CI?
So they can go to pre-commit.ci. Got a fancy international domain.
Nice. And then I can run it against any repo?
So it currently only supports GitHub. There are plans to add other version control providers in the future, but... For now, the first version is entirely GitHub, and right now it is only public repositories. I'm currently working with GitHub to enable a paid version that would work on private repositories.
Okay.
But soon, maybe by the time the podcast comes out, it'll be available.
Well, I hope so, because I really want this to be. I can't imagine not running this. It just makes sense.
Yeah, it's also stupid easy to set up. It's you're already using pre-commit, you might as well enable pre-commit CI.
Okay, so let's say I do, but then I, for some reason, don't want to anymore. Can I
uninstall? Yeah, you can just uninstall the app, and then that's done through... There's a little manage repositories button on pre-commit CI, which will take you to GitHub to add or remove repositories.
Okay. Yeah, and a lot of this stems around... I mean, it's making sure your code's correct, but also things like style, and you broke the tests, and or you broke, that isn't covered by this, but you did something wrong. It's way easier to get a computer to tell you did something wrong than a person. I mean, emotionally, don't you think?
Yeah. Let me read the tagline that someone in my Twitch chat actually came up with that I really like, and I think it encapsulates this idea perfectly. And it's that developers spend a fair chunk of time during their development flow on fixing relatively trivial problems in their code. Pre-commit CI both enforces that these issues are discovered, which is opt-in for each developer's workflow via pre-commit, but also fixes the issues automatically, letting developers focus their time on more valuable problems.
Wow. Nice copy.
Yeah, I really like that. And the big selling point that I've used when talking about this tool, both pre-commit and pre-commit CI, is you can spend your time in a code review nitpicking white space and commas and, operator positioning and all that other stuff. Or you can set up a computer, which is very, very good at identifying these things, and spend more of your time in code review focusing on architectural and design problems instead of nitpicking style. And I think that's like the big selling point of linters, code formatters, and like this entire, you know, genre of tools.
Yeah. Yeah. And also just, I mean, it just is pleasant. I mean, I've had style guides that are like, not, there's no way you could write a tool to, or maybe there is a way to write a tool for it, but they're so specific to a mm-hmm. company, and just have, it's actually refreshing in the Python world to have a fairly limited number of options of essentially most people don't care. Just tell me how you want me to style the code and I'll do it. Mm-hmm. And then actually some of the defaults that we've chosen in Python are just pleasant to use anyway, like snake case and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
There's like 10% of us that actually care about code style, and we all have our own style, and it just doesn't make sense for all of us to be writing our own style guide. So
for sure. Yeah. The thing that I often bring up in code reviews, like if I encounter, you know, someone else or myself reaching towards like, oh, well, this could be, you know, if you adjusted the spacing or something, like if I'm ever like even starting thinking about that thought, I've instead shifted to saying like, how can we write an automated tool to enforce this style? And if we can't, then I just don't even mention it at all. Like if it's not important to the architecture of the change, it's not worth my time or the author's time for bringing up something like that.
Okay. I've got one. I'm making this long, but I am part of the 10% that cares about this.
I am too.
One of the things that like that violates all of these style guides mm-hmm. that I still do sometimes, and I don't really know how to turn off the reformatters from doing mm-hmm. it, is let's say I've got like what is essentially a bunch of like maybe a list of lists or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is easier to read if I align all the commas up so that it like looks like a table.
Yep.
But that violates all these black and all that stuff. So is there a solution to this, or should I just stop liking to make things tables?
Yeah, I don't have a good solution for that.
Okay.
I also understand the goal, the like idea of lining stuff up, and it does look nice when it's manually formatted that way. I have not found a good combination of things that allow something like this. I mean, with black, you can do format off, but that doesn't prevent your linter from saying, "Oh, your white space is messed up." I think I'm actually kind of pondering some ideas in Flake 8 to enable something like this. Which would allow a plugin to filter error codes in the output such that you could, you know, say, you know, inside format blocks, ignore white space base change, or format off blocks, you could ignore white space base things. And so that would give you a way to, you know, opt into that sort of idea. But I don't have any solutions today.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's not a common thing. It's not like all over the place I'm violating this. It's just, And it's not just because I think it looks nicer. It's really intended to minimize human error.
Yeah, because it's a maintainability improvement. I agree with that, so, yeah. Another thing that you can do is sequester it to a particular file. So if you have like a data tables file or whatever, I mean, that's probably a poor name for a file, but you could put your particular thing in a particular file. And both pre-commit and Flake 8 have exclusion options. So you could say like, you know, in Flake 8 or in pre-commit, you would just say exclude, and then it wouldn't run the particular tool at that. In Flake 8, you can use per file ignores to ignore particular error codes in particular files. So if you have like one file that violates one rule that you want to enforce everywhere else, but not in this file, you can turn it off on a per file basis. You can also, you know, if it's a one line thing, you can use no QA, but you know, putting no QA on 20 lines is maybe not the best.
Okay. Thanks a ton for talking about this. Again, so people want to check out normal pre-commit, it's at pre-commit.com mm-hmm. and pre-commit.ci is your CI tool.
Yep.
And then people can just Google all the other stuff, Python mm-hmm. Flake 8, stuff like that.
Yeah, sounds great.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for joining the show, and I hope you have a great day.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, and I hope your day is great as well.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Test and Code. Let's keep in touch. Head over to pythontest.com/contact to reach out to me /newsletter so that I can reach you, or /support if you'd like to, you know, get a course or something. That's all for now. Now go out and test something.